The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin period, rioting in Paris, November of 1380. Now, when we left off last time, it was November the 15th, 1380, and a large crowd had gathered at the Place de la Grève to protest the taxation of the war. Many of them were wearing party-colored hoods and tunics of green and white, the city's colors. On the eastern side of this large open space stood the Maison aux Piliers, the seat of the provost of the merchants, and the four écuvins, a body drawn from the higher ranks of the Parisian guilds, who over a period of more than a century had gradually come to assume the powers of the municipality. These men represented the aristocracy of the city's trades. Most of them had done well by the crown's policies in the past 20 years, and their interests had been well satisfied by the abolition of the hearth tax. But the main concern in November 1380 was to preserve their own authority, caught as they were between the demands of the government and the anger of the masses. The provost of the merchants came to the front of the building to address the crowd. He tried to persuade them to disperse and leave the issue to their betters. He was greeted by a ferocious harangue from a leather dresser in the crowd. This man inveighed not just against taxes, but against the rich of the city and the conspicuous consumption of the royal court. Quote, "Will we never see an end to the mounting greed of these lords?" This man asked, according to the appalled chronicler, Saint Denis. "They fed off our goods, these people whose only thought is to decorate themselves in gold and jewelry, surround themselves with trains of flunkies, put up superb palaces, and devise fresh taxes with which to crush the city." He finished with a call to arms. About 300 men surged forward with weapons in their hands. They seized the provost of the merchants and marched him across the bridge to the palace on the island, where the Estates General was meeting. They invaded the courtyard and then the great hall, shouting their demands so that they could be heard by the young king and his four uncles gathered in an upper room with their advisers and officials. Whatever else might be said of the Duke of Anjou, he did not lack courage. Accompanied by the Dukes of Berry and Burgundy, the constable, and the chancellor, he entered the hall and confronted the mob. The provost of the merchants made a long speech. He described the misery and the poverty of the population in graphic language. He called for an immediate end to war taxation. The provost was a reluctant protester, but he played his part well. A great roar of approval went up when he had finished. The Duke played for time. He told them that their case would be considered by the council. The truth was that the council was divided. Many of its members were concerned about precedent which would be set by yielding the threats and violence. What would the mob demand next? Their doubts were silenced as the crowd outside grew larger and more menacing. The chancellor emerged once more, this time to pronounce the abolition of the fouage, the aides, and the gabelle. An ordinance confirming this decision was hastily prepared. The council's judgment of the mood of crowd was borne out by what followed. After the shouts of Noel and Montjoy Saint-Denis came the cry of Au Juifs. The main Jewish quarter of Paris lay on the right bank between the Place de Grève and the Châtelet, district of narrow lanes and crowded tenements. Crowds streamed across the Pont de Changière and invaded the Juiverie, killing Jews, forcibly baptizing their children, wrecking their homes, tearing up loan books, and carrying off jewelry and plate left as pledges. They were urged on from the streets outside by the young noblemen who were the Jews' main clients. The rest of the Ile-de-France took their cue from Paris. As the news of these events spread across northern France, in one town after another, the celebrations turned into pogroms against the Jews. The council had no intention of accepting the situation. The abandonment of taxation was plainly not an option for a nation at war. They reviewed their concessions as no more than a tactical retreat and greatly resented the threats by which they had been obtained. They resolved to try again, this time in stages. The Estates General was reassembled and persuaded to agree to the principle of war taxation, but they were invited to consult their constituents about its exact form. On November the 17th, 1380, as the representatives returned to their homes, orders went out to all the baileys in the northern France area, requiring them to convene local assemblies to consider the financial needs of the government away from the pressures of the Parisians. The idea was to set the provinces up against the capital. Unfortunately, the government had underestimated the intensity of public hostility, which was by no means confined to the poor of Paris. In many towns in northern France, the assessments were believed to be distorted in favor of the wealthy mercantile elite, and social resentments were as strong as anywhere. By God's blood, the fur hats never pay their due, one man shouted in the streets of Seine. The government cause was not helped by the exaggerated reports about the size of the dead king's hoarded treasure, and the widespread knowledge of the Duke of Anjou's theft from it. The threat from England did not always seem to be a good answer to men who had never understood the logic of avoiding battle. In November, the assembly met in the Archbishop's Palace at Rouen on December the 10th, 1380. They were pressed by the king's commissioners with the urgent need to raise an army of 8,000 men against the English. The clerical contingent was stuffed with royal officials, and the nobility with men had been prominent in the wars of the Contine and the Breton March. They urged their colleagues to accept a sales tax, if not at the traditional rate, at least a reduced one. But the towns and a substantial part of the nobility would have none of it. No, no, they cried. Normandy, with its close association with the crown, could not be persuaded, and there was not much chance of getting better answers elsewhere. None of the local assemblies whose proceedings are recorded was prepared to make a grant. They all referred the decision back to the next meeting of the Estates General. The representatives reassembled in Paris shortly before Christmas in 1380. Their deliberations, which extended over about 2 weeks, are not recorded, but the outcome can be deduced from the successive ordinances issued in the first 3 months of 1381. It was a firm reassertion of the principle of control over taxation by representative assemblies. The government had to submit to the abolition, not just of the fouages covered by the dying declaration of Charles V, but the aides and the gabel and all other taxes levied on crown's authority going back to the beginning of the century. In return, the king was granted a war tax for a limited period of 1 year, starting from March the 1st, 1381, to cover the cost of a standing army of 4,000 men-at-arms and 2,000 crossbowmen. The precise basis of assessment was left to the estates of each province to decide and might differ from one province to the other. The assessment and the collection of the new tax, moreover, was to be left in the hands of local officials, answerable to their own provincial assemblies and not to the king. These people were charged with ensuring that every penny collected was spent on the prosecution of the war and the cost of the king's household. Nothing would be diverted into the pockets of the king's relations and ministers. The ordinances, if they had lasted, would have marked the dismantling of the system of national taxation devised by the ministers of King John II and Charles V in the 1360s, which had been the foundation of France's military recovery. There would have been a revision of the old system, which had applied before 1360, when for practical purposes grants from the Estates General had operated as decisions in principle only, to be followed by a wearing and time-consuming round of local negotiations. Few men outside the Chambre des Comptes could have recalled how far that process had paralyzed successive French kings in every crisis. On this occasion, even with a large English army besieging Nantes, it was to take more than 2 months to negotiate a variety of different regional taxes in several provincial cities with different groups of interested parties, each with their own grievances to be redressed, before any funds came to the treasury. Some local assemblies insisted that the proceeds of local collections should be reserved not just for war expenditures, but for particular kinds of war expenditures of specifically local concern. Thus, the taxes of Champagne were earmarked for the defense of the northern frontier, opposite Calais and Flanders, those in Normandy for the garrisons on the Cherbourg front. These concessions, no doubt, had to be made to get the tax grant through. Even so, receipts must have fallen far short of the minimum required to defend the frontiers of France. The Estates General of December 1380 marked the shift of power by insisting on the king's formal confirmation of the charters and liberties of every province of Languedoc. It was a symbolic act, but an important one nonetheless. Most of these instruments dated back to the rebellions of 1314 and 1315. It followed the death of Philip the Fair. They were still remembered as the high watermark of regional autonomy in France. So this is really messing up the country trying to defend itself from the English. But then again, England's finances isn't much better, so we'll go and visit them next time. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.